This edition of The Stack was first broadcast on March the 9th, 2013, on Monocle 24.
A caffeine-fueled magazine celebrating independent business, an editor with a wealth of experience across magazines and publishing strategy, and a tote full of exciting new editions. Plenty to keep you warm and well-informed today on edition 28 of The Stack. Publish and be damned, we'll visit the 10th edition of the annual fair for self-publishers to discover whether the old adage still applies.
We attract such a range of publications, everything from architecture to kind of more comic strip to quite like top shelf kind of material.
And we hear about the impact of the e-reader experiment on the Japanese publishing scene.
Comparing with UK and US, our newspaper industry is still strong.
All that and a few more choice reading tips besides, all to come today on edition 28 of The Stack, live from Studio One here in London. Hello and welcome to edition 28 of The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Every Saturday we sit down with editors and photographers, correspondents and creative directors to review the best in established weeklies and obscure journals, big city dailies and one-off personal projects. This week we've seen another blow to print in the form of Time Warner spinning off its Time Inc. publishing arm. So what does that piece of news mean for the tricky business of publishing? Well, given that our editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé is currently sipping on a sake in Tokyo, I'm your host for the next hour who'll be trying to answer that question. We'll be exploring whether free sheets, tablet apps or traditional approaches provide the best means of staying ahead of the game. So there's plenty to get through and it's time to meet our guests. Our first guest is Ted Moncrief, editor of Bloomberg Pursuits magazine, the global lifestyle luxury publication from Bloomberg Markets magazine. Ted previously worked for Condé Nast Traveler for 15 years, including 4 years as executive editor. Following that, he was executive editor at Newsweek and then executive editor and content strategist at W magazine. Ted, welcome to The Stack. I wanted to start by asking you about Bloomberg Pursuits then. Just tell us a little bit about what the sort of general objectives are here. What's your kind of guiding principle in terms of bringing this magazine to the market?
The guiding principle is that Bloomberg has 375,000 customers around the world. Average age is 38. 60% of the readership is outside the United States. And the household income is slightly south of $500,000. So they have this audience, and I think it occurred to the company that they should begin addressing their life outside the office, which previously they'd been extraordinarily good about addressing their life inside the office.
Now, tell me a little bit then about the sort of market as you see it generally in terms of, you know, lifestyle, luxury, if you like. What's the health of that? Because obviously there's a lot of concerns in the world about, you know, the contraction post-2008, all of these kind of concerns. But a lot of the sort of luxury businesses, pretty robust. Do you get the sense that it's the same kind of story in the magazine sector? Are you fairly confident about how the market's shaping up?
Yeah, I think the luxury end of the market is doing extraordinarily well despite the economic downturn. And I think the magazines that are in that space are also doing well. I think the challenge for most luxury magazines is, you know, a decline in magazine readership to some extent. You know, the advantage we have is that we didn't build it and then try to build the audience. We had the audience and then we built the magazine to serve them, which in my mind is an enormous strategic advantage because the readership is stable and we know precisely who they are because of their relationship with Bloomberg.
I think we'll talk a little more later in the program about the kind of strategies perhaps that people are using to counter some of those, well, what are perceived as downward trends in the print publication, but that we all think are probably wrong. But also joining me around the table today is Scott Bentley, owner and creative director of Caffeine, the UK's only consumer coffee magazine, a title that promises to champion independent coffee makers in print and online. Welcome to you too, Scott. Let's talk a little bit about Caffeine. What are the particular challenges then facing you, do you think, when you're launching this kind of title, and how are you trying to tackle them?
I don't know, really. I mean, I can only talk about, well, why I decided to launch this, and that was that I fell in love with coffee, and I went on a coffee journey, as it were. I was going to a lot of the chains and not necessarily enjoying the coffee on a regular basis. Sometimes it was good, sometimes it was terrible. And I wanted to learn more. And what I kind of noticed was that it was really the only place to find out more was either on really difficult to penetrate websites where guys will be talking about, you know, extraction times of coffee and real kind of geeky stuff. And so I kind of wanted to make it a little bit more friendly, and I wanted to bring people along on their personal journey, like I had come. So, yeah.
And tell me a little bit more about that personal journey, because I gather it was a very personal experience to you. Is it you met your sort of partner, and it was very much about, you know, sharing those experiences with coffee. Do you think that often it takes that kind of spark to really like bring on a passion of an area like coffee?
Yeah, I think coffee is one of those. It's one of those things. It's and in much the same way of wine, that when you really start to get into it, you get in quite deep. I think there's a lot. I mean, it's a really funny thing. The second most traded commodity in the world is coffee, and yet very few people really think or get too in depth about it. But it can go really. You can get really in depth with it. The kind of complexity and the kind of taste that you can get from coffee are equal in a lot of ways to wine. So I'm trying to get people to maybe, you know, walk past that chain, walk into an independent, find something a little bit better, something that's been crafted, and get the people to then start saying, okay, well, maybe I'll do this at home. Yeah, maybe I'll kind of have a. Maybe I'll get an espresso machine at home, or maybe I'll grind my own beans, or go and find, you know, where this finca is in, you know, in Brazil. So yeah,
that's the challenge, I suppose, is to often demystify some of that. You have a lot of mystique around things like coffee, as you said. A lot of the coverage can be quite in depth. Ted, I wondered, you've worked across so many varied titles. How often do you think that is a recurrent challenge? Which, that is to say, to try and deliver to the consumer something that's attractive, that's accessible, but that's maybe not too sort of bogged down in jargon. Is that often something that is a challenge, do you think, within the magazine sector?
I think it's an opportunity, because I think a lot of luxury or anything that's artisanal, or the word you use, craft, there's a lot that goes into it. There are interesting stories there, and I think it's an opportunity to explain to people, to go beneath the surface and explain to them something that they didn't already know. I think, you know, a lot of magazines are very good about telling you who made it and telling you the price, and after that you're really on your own. And I think especially when you're talking about any essentially artisanal industry, that's really the tip of the iceberg, and beneath that tip are often fascinating stories.
Well, we're going to be looking at this in a bit more depth later. We'll also be exploring something about the kind of particular challenges of magazines that are free to the market, and how you can actually do a lot more with them than perhaps might meet the eye later in the programme. But for now, we're going to look at the 10th edition of the annual fair for self-publishers, Publish and Be Damned, which took place earlier this month at the ICA in London. The fair featured more than 50 publishers, from urbanism magazines to experimental architectural titles. There was something for everyone, showing that the future of magazines is promising. Our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, visited the fair and spoke to some of the publishers and the organisers of the event.
My name's Kate Phillimore. I'm one of three organisers of Publish and Be Damned. I'm also an independent curator.
My name's Louise O'Hare, and I'm one of three organisers of Publish and Be Damned, and I also associate editor at After All.
I just want to ask, how did it all started? Can you tell us a bit more about how did you came up with the idea and a little bit more about the fair itself?
Well, I think Publish and Be Damned started in 2004, initially by Kit Hammonds and Emily Pethick. And I think the idea basically came out of a lot of their colleagues and friends were self-publishing, but had very few options in terms of distribution. So the fair was an opportunity to all get together and distribute your publications to the larger population, but also to kind of share and trade amongst each other as well.
And how do you see the magazine industry at the moment? Are you positive?
Am I positive about the magazine industry? I think it's a bit of a wide question. I think magazines continue to be produced. I think there's obviously a lot of people who are moving online or making use of online platforms. So if you're thinking about a physical magazine, that's changing. But I think that there's still a desire. I mean, when you say a magazine rather than a fanzine or a journal, I think of something which has advertising in it, actually. I don't know if that's might necessarily make sense, but there's still a desire for people to advertise in print because they believe that printed matter actually is a more viable way than online. So all magazines that have it's a print run that advertisers want to know about. So I'd say that that's interesting to do with the idea of producing printed matter as well.
Do you see any trends in particular this year?
Any trends?
Not particularly. Not like, I mean, I think we attract such a range of publications, everything from architecture to kind of more comic strip to quite like, you know, top shelf kind of material.
So we actually try to not have a look. I think often when you go to various sort of art book fairs, there feels there's a sort of style of work that comes out of that kind of context. And Publish Me Damned is much more, aims to be much more diverse, as well as being able to invite smaller presses, because all of the publishers are here for free, and almost all other book fairs, unless they've done an advertising exchange, will be there. All the publishers there will have paid to be there, and this gives us the opportunity to work with very small scale and individuals as well, so artists self-publishing their work as well. So that's one of the reasons that we hope that it's really diverse and that maybe there aren't any trends.
While walking through the fair, I could see a fascinating range of publishers, and I spoke to some of them. I started talking to Rashid Ali, editor of the urbanism magazine Pair.
We began to really do Pair in order to focus and to share ideas with people that are not normally featured in the mainstream sort of architectural press. And also we were interested in this threshold between architecture and culture, so it's not really just about sort of buildings. So essentially we look at how sort of artists, sociologists, people in cultural theory sort of deal and look at the city. So it's about the threshold of kind of cultural ideas rather than just architecture itself.
Can you tell us what's being featured on the latest issue?
Essentially, normally we have a place or a theme. And, you know, previously we've had, for example, Istanbul, and the latest issue is about Medellin, which is an incredible city that's just actually yesterday was voted the most innovative city in the world for the amazing sort of contextual ideas in terms of how the city has been transformed socially, culturally, politically, and spatially.
I'm Sophia Niazi, and I'm one of the three girls behind One of My Kind magazine.
I'm Saba Khan. I'm the second of the three girls from One of My Kind magazine.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the magazine? What does it talk about?
Well, the three of us came together. We've all come from like the zine self-publishing world, and we wanted to create a magazine that reflected diversity in terms of spirituality and ethnicity and world views and beliefs. And we didn't feel that there was anything out there that represented a sort of universal overarching kind of reaching out. And because we all come from like a Muslim ethnic background living in the UK, we thought it'd be quite interesting to tap into that kind of social arena that we come from and try to, you know, encourage the arts and craft from where we come from.
What's been featured in the latest issue?
We're working on a thematic basis. So the first issue, we've looked at fabric, and we've got contributions from people like Betsy Greer, who termed the craftivism movement, and she's combining craft with activism and trying to use craft as a way of addressing issues that are important in the world. And we've got features like a Shiro, who's like a female hero, and for this issue it's a woman called Gareth Pierce, who's a human rights lawyer, And she's been involved in quite a lot of the cases that have affected people from our community, like Muslim people who are facing miscarriages of justice. Another feature we have is an artist called Hannah Tajima, and she's really big in the Muslim fashion scene. And yeah, you'll have to check the magazine out to find out.
My name's Max Fusmitskevich. I'm the editor and publisher of Tremors magazine.
Can you describe the magazine for me?
Tremors is an arts and architecture journal. Our writing is between 1,000 and 2,500 words, so it's more essays and longer format interviews. Everything we do is original artwork that's published for the magazine. So we have a lot of illustrators, a lot of architects, and artists who contribute and think about what they're doing in terms of the theme of the magazine, not only just getting images off press or anything like that. So when you look at some of the illustrations that run with the features, the illustrator's been thinking about their own ideas. It's not just, just creating an image to run with a feature. Our past issue we did was about the whole Olympic site being reformatted, and we did a walk with Ian Sinclair, and we got a photographer, Oliver Griffin, who specializes in situationism, to do the walk with him. So they were both interested in the same topics. And for this issue, we've done outsider architecture. So we're looking at basically architectural counterculture. We're not a trade magazine or not a news magazine. We're much more of a kind of research-based magazine.
For those who say the magazine industry is in trouble, I would have to disagree. For Monocle, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And we'll be discussing the health or otherwise of the publishing industry in a little more detail next, as well as hearing about Japan's latest e-reader experiment.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental. It does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close. And there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well. It has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's A Review, every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. I'm still with Ted and Scott. Let's talk a little bit about some of the challenges then posed to magazines. We talked about, you know, the digitization. We're looking at things like e-readers, tablets, this kind of thing. And Ted, I know that there's an app, I guess, coming out with this new edition of Bloomberg Pursuits. Tell me a little bit about what your thinking is behind that. Is it something very much that you view as a complement to the magazine, or is it something that rivals it in some way? How do you see that balance?
I think there's a couple of things. The app will launch on March 15th, and it will be the magazine reconfigured for the app, and there's an opportunity for additional material. There's an incredible apartment in there that we're doing a video tour of. The thing that I think most interesting about it is that as a magazine maker, you know, I love the web, but as a magazine maker, the iPad, it has more in common with print, I think, than it does with the internet, in that you can craft a wholly immersive environment, whereas I think we've all grown accustomed on the internet to clicking in and clicking out, and we're very promiscuous, whereas an app, you're in it, and when you're in it, you're in it, and you can fashion a kind of 360 environment. And there's definitely facets of the stories in the current issue that we're eager to explore, and the iPad gives us the opportunity to do that, whether it's an interview with a subject or a video tour or a slideshow. It just gives you a lot more tools to play with.
And Scott, tell me, I know Caffeine, again, likewise, there'll be an app rolled out. Do you see it similarly as something that can enhance the experience? Or is it in some ways, do you think, almost like a rival, especially when you're dealing with, you know, a free magazine? Do you ever have any fears that it could sort of almost undermine the print title? Or is that not something that concerns you?
Not at the moment. Because Caffeine's only available in central London, essentially. So I get, I don't know, five tweets or emails a day from people saying, I'm in York, I want it. I'm in Glasgow, Edinburgh, Dublin, Portugal and the US, actually. And I said, well, I can't physically send it to you. And because it's free, I can't really charge you for it. So I'm just losing cash on that. So if I do an iPad app, you can download it. And the wonderful thing about the iPad experience is, as Ted says, and we've got a video interview with a barista. We can have tutorials in there on how to create great latte art. So there's so many things you can do more with the iPad. But the initial reason for doing it in a print format is because you don't generally go into a coffee shop and then download an app. So we wanted something that people could go in and they're instantly in the print mag. You know, so iPad definitely has its place in the market, but I don't think it necessarily fights with the print.
Now let's talk a little bit about that kind of newsstand appeal. We've got our covers here. Ted, let's start with you. I just want to ask you about the particular Bloomberg Pursuits. What is it? I have to say, quite a striking cover. Tell me about, well, perhaps describe for our listeners what we're looking at, and tell us a little bit more about the thought process behind this one.
It's an alligator with an alligator wallet clenched in its jaws.
And I noticed that you didn't bring the alligator. Sadly, you didn't bring the alligator to me to stay, but I gather he's maybe doing some press work.
Yes, we get a lot of requests since we came out with this cover for the alligator, and the alligator is better suited to television because if you don't keep it below 40 degrees Fahrenheit, I don't know what that is in Celsius, it gets nasty.
We're not too far away temperature-wise here.
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially a tropical animal, so if you keep it cold, you keep it docile.
Yeah, I think people try that with some of the staff here at Monocle 24 on occasions. And Scott, looking at Caffeine, I guess it's a celebration of coffee. It's a celebration of, you know, the art of coffee. So in a sense, you've got here a depiction, as you said, of, you know, a latte art, if you like. I guess there was never really any other way to go, perhaps, with this cover.
Especially not for the first edition. And I think the thing that we find, I think somebody was telling me today, actually, that one of the most Instagrammed pictures are people's coffee latte art. And there's even a World Latte Art Championship. So, but it's very much a mark of quality coffee. You'd never get that in a chain. It's usually someone taking real care. So it's quite often a moniker for good quality coffee.
Now, I think it's always quite an interesting sort of issue to look at cover art, particularly sort of cover stars, something that, you know, there was always this idea that you could add certain volumes to your monthly newsstand sales just by who you featured and how they were shot. And it's interesting looking at a couple of copies. I know we've got a copy of the Gentlewoman here with Beyonce, looking very fetching, quite sort of demure in this cover, rather different to the Gentlewoman's previous covers, which had sort of Angela Lansbury kind of 70s style. It's quite interesting, Scott, isn't it, how you can have such a different cover even with the same cover star, like Beyonce, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember the title it was, but very recently there was a newsstand titled something like Glamour or Vogue or something, with Beyonce on the cover and treated in such completely different ways. Yeah, I mean, something like the Gentlewoman, it's probably Beyonce is someone you wouldn't really expect to be on there, but then again, you wouldn't expect Angela Lansbury either, so... They do a great job in really taking things from a completely different angle.
And Ted, when you're looking at your sort of magazines, what's the first thing that generally strikes you? Is it the simple image, if it's something very arresting? Or does it tend to be, I mean, I noticed we were browsing at the Outpost earlier and you remarked upon the sort of pleasing tactile quality. Is it more about the touch of the magazines? When is the first impressions that it strikes you?
I think the first impression is the cover, and what I'm looking for is to be surprised. I think we're inundated with so many images that, you know, the prize goes to the person who, or the magazine that gets your attention, and that often means that they have zigged while everyone else has zagged. I mean, you look at the Gentlewoman, and, you know, a magazine like Glamour is a much more commercial title, obviously, and they tend to shout, partly because they're trying to attract such an enormous audience, whereas the Gentlewoman, the thing that I love about this image is that it's more of a whisper.
That's very elegantly put. Very, very nice. I just wondered if we can pick up then on sort of your background. Obviously, you've got a great wealth of experience across a number of titles throughout publishing over the last few years. Are there any kind of key strands, do you think, that are the same wherever you work, whatever the particular challenge is, in terms of things like newsstand appeal and, you know, how you connect with readers? Or do you always find that you're kind of back to square one as you sort of move to a new title, a new project? Is it always a completely new set of parameters, or are there things that you can kind of take with you as you travel through?
I think it's about communicating and to some extent entertaining. And the minute you know the audience, the I think you know the strategy that's best for them. It's easier, I will say, that it, you know, Bloomberg Pursuits is a much more, I would say, specific and unified audience than, say, Condé Nast Traveler, even though the subject is much narrower. The thing that's great about that as an editor is you know exactly where the plate is, and you know exactly how to, I know exactly how to pitch over it. Whereas general interest magazines, they're trying to appeal to a much broader spectrum. They're trying to be all things to all people, and I think that's a very difficult thing to do in this market.
And Scott, what's your view on this? I mean, obviously, again, you have a lot of different experience. There's whole different areas, you know, in consumer magazines, that kind of thing. What do you think about that idea? Are there sort of key strands that you always try and retain wherever you're ploughing your furrow, or do you think it's a clean slate each time?
I certainly don't think it's a clean slate, but you do build up a knowledge over time. I mean, I've been designing magazines now for 15 years, and generally speaking, in the consumer sector. So, I mean, everything from sort of Men's Health, FHM, Arena, Top Gear. But what you do tend to find is there's certain things work in certain markets. So, but I do think the Ted makes a very good point in the fact that those sort of general interest magazines really are on the decline. You can't appeal to everyone with such broad strokes, and that's the reason that niche titles are really coming up, is because you can speak far more directly. I don't think you can say that don't put green on the cover. That seems to be this kind of publisher's thing. No, never put green on the cover, which I've always thought was hilarious, but it's still to this day. You never see a green cover.
Now, what intrigues me about that is you listed some of your the places you worked before. Some of them kind of not macho, but you know, pretty kind of hard hitting. You imagine a pretty kind of straight, you know, MO. You've got things like motoring magazines, Men's Health, that sort of thing. With something that I guess is a little more nuanced, something like Caffeine. How have you found that transition? Was that actually difficult, or have you kind of enjoyed the discovering what it is that makes this kind of thing tick?
I think it's because I have such a passion for the subject matter that I've actually, rather than being an art director that is being led by an editor's vision, I'm almost editing it to a degree myself. And so that's my vision. So I've kind of gone that way about it. I don't have any food magazine experience, and very little experience in magazines which kind of cross over. But I don't know. I like to think that as a consumer magazine designer, you think about your public, you think about who's going to read it, and then you should design for that. You know, if you're a lone wolf designer and you want to create an incredibly niche title and then put a £12 cover charge on it, that's a completely different audience. You know.
And Ted, then in terms of your sort of previous experience, you mentioned Condé Nast Traveler. Sort of coming to Bloomberg Pursuits, have you found any of those transitions particularly challenging or difficult along the way? And what are the kind of key strengths, if you like, that you've acquired that maybe you've brought to bear now on this latest project?
I think the thing about any more specific title is it just gives you a great deal of freedom. I mean, at Traveler, blue covers sold well, and so inevitably that's where you go. You know, it's nice to have a wider range to work with.
Exactly. I think I've got to say, for me, the Gator combo is definitely a winner for this month.
Thank you.
We'll be coming back shortly, and we're going to hear a little bit more about the impact of the e-reader experiment on the Japanese publishing scene. Now, Japan has a great relationship with the printed word. Despite just over a decade of falling print sales, the country's trade in physical books and magazines is still a strong one. However, as in other countries, the e-reader and tablet has offered Japanese publishers a new method of distributing their products. Takehiro Endo is an expert in the Japanese publishing industry, particularly on the impact of the e-reader on the publishing sector. Mark Thomas spoke to Endo as he was delivering a lecture on his latest research into the effect of the e-reader experiment in Japan.
The print industry in Japan is huge. The Japanese Book Publishers Association says that between 3,800 publishing companies in Japan, about 80% of them based in Tokyo, 1.8 trillion yen in books and magazine sales are generated annually. Takehiro Endo, who prefers to be called Endo when he's not in Japan, is a researcher at Cardiff University's Japanese Study Center. An expert in the Japanese publishing industry, Endo has recently completed a research project into the reasoning behind the poor uptake of the e-reader in Japan.
I have been interested in the creativity and economy. You have to be creative if you want to make something very interesting content. But on the other hand, you have to make money. I have been very much interested in this tension in the organization, like how they manage these competing directions.
The Japanese publishing system is rooted in the country's history. The original distribution system, which today's industry is based on, has its beginnings in Imperial Japan.
A wholesaler's distribution system was introduced in Japanese publishing industry in 1941, when there was still World War II. And the purpose was to ensure only censored books can be distributed.
Many aspects of that imperial system continue to exist in the current Japanese publishing market. In response to the falling sales of printed books and magazines in the late 90s, in the early 2000s, Japanese publishers tried unsuccessfully to launch e-readers and a series of e-dictionaries.
In 2004, Sony and Panasonic introduced digital book readers, and both of the camps continued to stay in the Japanese market until 2008. The reason why they retreated from the Japanese market was they couldn't gather content from the publishers. And this is related to the experience of the e-dictionaries. I guess British people may not be familiar with electronic dictionaries, but in Japan it's quite a big market. You can see here the more than 2 million machines are sold since 2000, around 2000, and it's quite popular.
For Japanese publishers, the experiment ended within just a few years when it became clear that the makers of e-dictionaries' demands for more content at the same fee were unsustainable for the publishers themselves.
This really gave two lessons to Japanese publishers. The first lesson was losers and winners become clearer. And this one. Because the makers of the electronic dictionaries, they are not so much familiar with the dictionary's varieties. So they want to just load the content, which is quite, popular in printed dictionary.
Japan's old and existing system is based on the idea that you distribute books at a fixed price through a national distributor who will send books to the furthest flung corners of Japan's islands. If they are not sold by booksellers, they can return them free of charge to the distributor, who will move the copies to a place that is selling the title better. This means that selling printed books and magazines in Japan is a favourable and secure industry to be in.
Print publishers, operation is quite easy. They don't have to consider the fluctuation of prices. Once they've set the price, they can just stick to it. And another advantage, this is in particular for magazine publishers, because the advertisement, the fee is determined in association with the number of copies sold. So if you want to maximize the revenue from the advertisement, a good way is to maximize the sales of magazines. And this is free return policy. It's kind of no risk for wholesalers and bookstores. So if you take the risk, publishers take the risk of inventory, then wholesalers and bookstores, they are more than happy to display the books or magazines from the publishers, and that can maximize the exposure to potential customers.
Yotaro Okamoto has worked for Japan's second largest newspaper, the Asahi Shimbun, for more than 15 years. He says that in Japan, the news industry is still in favor of print and is struggling to find its feet where digital is concerned.
Comparing with UK and US, our newspaper industry is still strong. Our major newspaper companies have still one of the biggest circulations in the world. We cannot get enough profit from digital edition, and the efforts totally depends on printed publishing of printed edition. So we are still struggling and cannot see the future the vision of our industry in digital era.
Amazon's Kindle was very late to launch in the Japanese market, making its debut in the final quarter of 2012. But given the track record of the e-reader in Japan, it remains to be seen whether or not it will be able to replicate the early success that it has seen in other countries.
Currently, there are three different perceptions of e-dictionaries, e-book readers among publishers. The first one, it can become a threat of printed publishing. And this is also in particular the case for magazine publishers, because the magazines, the sales of magazines are also important revenue stream, but a more important or equally important revenue stream is from advertisement. So if you shift to e-book readers, maybe the important revenue streams may be lost. So the first recognition is e-book readers as threat, potential threat. And the second one is increasing number of incumbents in publishing industry. They tend to think, oh, this is inevitable. We have to do it in any case. This is a second dominant, recognition. And the third recognition is printed and digital can be coexisted. Kind of it can be possible to coexist digital and printed. And currently, I can see this sort of triangle. And it really depends on the recognition of publishers, whether in the future the content will be more provided by publishers or not. Yeah.
It might be too early to tell whether or not the e-reader will have a negative effect on the print industry in Japan, but Endo points out that currently he can't see the industry being damaged by the emergence of new technologies.
That's, I think, beyond my data, but what I can say is I am quite interested in publishers' response to Kindle, and as long as I can see from this stage, is publishers wouldn't provide the sort of core content to Kindle. They just provide, they just have provided content which already sold very well in the printed format.
The future of Japanese print looks good. Japan's print culture is linked closely to their enjoyment of books and magazines. The sales of comic books are still high, and the infrastructure that has stood the test of over half a century still looks healthy, despite some decline in the print market in recent years. One thing's for sure, Japan, along with the rest of the world, has demonstrated that it is still struggling to find a place for e-readers in a market which clearly still loves printed books and magazines. For Monocle, In Cardiff, I'm Mark Thomas.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Now, let's return, appropriately, to our stack of magazines. And Scott, I know you'd brought in a couple of other magazines, I guess, free publications. I suppose in many ways to show exactly why that should never be used pejoratively. And these kind of magazines are showing exactly what can be achieved despite that label. Tell us about some of these ones. This is a kind of very high production value. Tell us about some of the ones you brought in.
Yeah, so... My obviously, when you have print, someone's got to pay for it somewhere along the line, and whoever pays for it generally, you know, wants to control something. So, with Caffeine, we're just trying to get advertising in there to pay for the print. But something like this, it's Fourth and Main Journal, and this is the first one, and it comes out every season, every sort of clothing season, and they produce menswear. And what they've done here is they've got a very trim team together that has produced some really interesting articles about actors, artists, musicians, and they've bought in their menswear collection into that, and the photography is incredible and the writing's actually very good.
Tell us a little bit about the actual magazine because you're holding there, because it's quite kind of, how would you describe the cover? Fairly austere and fairly, again, quite a heavy paper stock, but it's a nice thing to hold, isn't it?
Yeah, it's matte. It's a matte stock. It's almost like a board. It's like an unfinished board with a gold Fourth and Main logo with the word journal underneath it, but there's no cover lines, there's no picture.
It looks suspiciously green to me as well.
Do you know what? Funny that, isn't it? yeah, so it's... It's a very weird format as well. It's a very tall and slim publication. And the word journal really does kind of sum up its sort of format. And I really like it for a number of reasons. It sits on my bookshelf and I quite often pull it down, not to particularly read it, but I love that there's so many things about it which doesn't kind of say I'm a magazine, but it is.
And tell me, Ted, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, do you find there are people who are particularly expert at delivering that kind of quality? I mean, as Scott points out, somebody's picking up the check somewhere, but it's quite a kind of knack, isn't it, to get that right on something like a free title of that sort?
Yeah, but I think that's where the revolution in print is taking place, which is that you see these independent titles that are often of a higher quality than publications that theoretically at least have many more resources. I think they become incredibly creative, incredibly artisanal. They're objects as well as magazines. I like to have them laying around just because they're such stupendous achievements of aesthetics.
I think these are quite often born out of passion, and I think what you kind of do tend to find with a lot of consumer magazines that have far better resources and far bigger teams is that quite often people are just thinking about when's 5:30 coming, you know, am I going to get that train? Whereas these guys are probably up till 12, 1 every night putting it together, and then they've still got a day job.
It's really interesting how often that, it's something of a recurring theme, that idea of people who have a real passion for print. Do you think that's still something that elevates this kind of form of media above some of the others? Or is that perhaps a slightly kind of condescending view of some of the new media? I certainly feel that. Do you not think there's a sense that people have a passion that goes beyond merely a profession? It is almost like an obsessive thing that some people have about print, do you think?
I don't think you would get into this. I don't think you get into publishing if you don't have a passion for it, because there ain't a lot of cash in it, as I've kind of, especially from my point of view. But I fell in love with it, and I think that's what you do. But I'm very much on the, I enjoy working in iPad formats, and I enjoy transferring print to iPad or just working on iPad. I mean, I was lucky enough to work briefly with my previous creative director, Chase Story, on Project Magazine, which was Richard Branson's kind of his debut publishing thing of doing iPad only. And that was incredible. We had such an amazing time putting stuff together there. But it was taken as seriously as any magazine that I've ever worked on as well. So, yeah, I do think there is people now coming through as the market is maturing, as the iPad market's maturing, better quality content and better design is happening on it.
And Ted, tell me, when you're, I'm sure, frequently sort of accosted by young, hungry upstarts who say, Ted, we need to pick your brain, we need to, you know, you need to unleash your wisdom to us, you know, how do we get started in this game and are we right to do it? Do you still say to them, yeah, it's the best decision you'll ever make, or are you sometimes slightly more sanguine about it?
I try to be realistic about it. I mean, I think there was a time where people went into publishing, you know, the phrase ink-stained wretch leaps immediately to mind. And then I think it became a real profession where you could potentially, at certain magazines, earn a great deal of money. And I think, if anything, it's returning to the days where people did it because they were driven to do it. And, you know, to my mind, very interesting things come of that.
Now, let's delve back into our stack of magazines. You've got a couple more in front of you. What have you brought along? Any particular things that have caught your eye on the newsstands this month?
The World of Interiors. But I love the World of Interiors. And I love it for the same reason I love a lot of these magazines, which is they seem oddly unconcerned with commercial considerations. You know, they do something that's very idiosyncratic. And I think there are a lot of magazines out there that show kind of, you know, anodyne international good taste, and World of Interiors rewards individual vision always. And that is something that I really appreciate, because the homogeneity can be quite deadening.
Absolutely. And anything particular in this month's issue that sort of particularly struck you? Or is it the very fact that you never really know what you're going to get from page to page that's such a delight?
I think you never really know what you're going to get page to page. And it really, there's something intensely voyeuristic about it. It doesn't feel like an Architectural Digest where the decorator just left and the owners haven't junked it up with their stuff. It's, you know, it's really a window into how people live, and people live in extraordinary ways, and not always extraordinarily opulent ways. You know, sometimes it's just plain crazy.
And Scott, we've got a few other titles here, including one or two sort of food-focused magazines, which I think is interesting to get your steer on, given the caffeine's direction. Mm. Any of those particularly strike you? And what is it about their outward appearance that catches the eye?
Yeah, I mean, I picked up Kinfolk here, and this is a guide for small gatherings, so it's kind of a dinner party sort of kind of magazine. And it's... you know, it's beautifully laid out, simply and beautiful at the same time. There's some lovely little ideas in here as well, which I really like. There is a feature, let me just get to it here, Dietary Confessions, where people are shot, as in a lineup, like a mugshot lineup, with their confession, i.e., you know, secret eater, grazer, bed eater, ketchup obsessed, just like my wife. So it's nice that a magazine that looks actually quite serious and still has a sense of humour. And I think one of the things that we're also trying to do in Caffeine is to not be so ridiculously serious about everything all the time. There can be light and shade.
I think that's quite important. As you said, there can be a slightly kind of po-faced attitude, particularly about the kind of coffee business. And it was interesting you made that comparison to fine wines, because there's sometimes a humorlessness about it, which can be a bit off-putting. So I imagine that was kind of at the forefront of your thinking.
Absolutely, yeah. We don't want to be, especially if you're new to the game, you don't want to be put off with the first article being about the provenance of a specific coffee from Kenya and, you know, the farmers. That's important and that should be told. That story is an important story, but it's not necessarily the first story for someone that's not really got into it before necessarily wants to read.
Ted, I know you were carrying on leafing through. Any other titles that you were browsing in? Perhaps one of your old stamping grounds here.
Yeah, I was just looking at W, which appeals to the... Kate Moss is on the cover, which, you know, is always a winner. And, you know, it appeals to the deeply superficial in me.
What is it about it that manages to appeal to that side of you so well?
I think they actually do some extraordinarily beautiful fashion shoots. Because they're known for their avant-garde photography, I think they push it sometimes to places where it's really a traffic accident, but it's a traffic accident that I enjoy watching.
Excellent stuff. If I could just sort of wrap up then, I just wonder what are the kind of main sort of messages that you've got? What's your main kind of preoccupations then? Obviously, you've got your new titles or relaunch titles, which is something that you're currently kind of obsessing about. If we throw it ahead into the coming sort of 6 months, 12 months, a couple of years down the line, do you think the same kind of worries, the preoccupations for aficionados of print media will be the same then, or are there any other kind of trends or changes that you kind of foresee that will be the things we'll be talking about when we talk in, say, 18 months or 2 years' time?
I think that the most interesting thing to keep an eye on is the iPad. You know, it seems the most promising vehicle for a true transition from print to digital. I honestly don't know whether we'll make it in that direction, because I think at least this generation, and I would argue the younger generation, because of all these independent publications, still seem to prefer having something tangible and real in their hands. I think there's something about all those ones and zeros that feel eminently disposable. You know, it's not a lean back experience.
And Scott, for you, the same kind of thoughts, or are you, I don't know, pessimistic anyway? I would think not, given you're just embarking on a fresh project.
Yeah, I know. Maybe I am slightly crazy about that. I think the digital way, especially iPads, is for me one that I'm investing in myself, and one that I'm being hired more and more to do. But the funny thing is that obviously there's lots of Me Too tablets on the Android and Kindle and stuff like that. They're incredibly difficult to design for, especially when Apple have set such a very high benchmark with the iPad, and you can do so many great things with it. And these other products, which generally come in at a cheaper price point, are downscaled in other ways, and they just don't physically work as well. And they're incredibly difficult to kind of translate, especially if I've just come back from working at Glamour, working on their iPad edition, where we also had to produce a Kindle version. And it was effectively, okay, take the iPad version, strip the guts out of it, and just, you know, put a couple of slideshows in there, because it just can't do anything. So I think the iPad is definitely the way forward, and yeah, that's the way I think.
In tandem, of course, with these inky pages and perhaps a fine flat white as well to take.
Oh, indeed.
Well, that brings us to the end of edition 28 of The Stack. My guests today have been Ted Moncrief and Scott Bentley. Our producer was Dawn Trump. And if you have any comments or queries, drop us a note at info@monocle.com. Remember, we'll be back next Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, 11 a.m. Berlin time, where Tyler Brule will be broadcasting live from the heart of the German capital. Of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye. Have a great weekend.